The big question, and this changes for everyone, is why do you buy a wine? And do you know where that wine actually comes from?
As I like to say, there's life after Cabernet Sauvignon.
The most expensive wine in the world is a Bloody Merlot. Why can't we be in that group? We can be.
It is important to adapt your rootstock to the location where you are and what you want to grow.
There's a moment in a red wine fermentation where it gets really foamy, froths up in your face, and it smells amazing. I think that's my favorite part.
We say, so drink the wine. That's kind of our motto here at Life Between the Vines. One of the cool things about wine, besides drinking it, is the people you drink it with. And the stories you hear and tell with wine all come together to make every bottle unique. Discovering and tasting wine shouldn't be a homework assignment. And we believe that the people who are closest to wine have the best stories. So open a bottle.
And welcome to podcast number 302. This week we feature Dr. Dave Miller of White Pine Winery in St. Joseph, Michigan. Continuing with our tour of Michigan wineries, this week we visit with Dr. Dave Miller of White Pine Winery. White Pine is located in St. Joseph, and while the tasting room is not located at the winery, it can be found in a bustling retail area in town. Dave has focused on wine education for most of his career, as well as helping growers work with vinifera. Michigan wineries have benefited from Dave's knowledge, and when you take the time to listen to this program, you will too. Michigan wines. We've been enjoying a few days of Michigan wines, and it's been an eye-opening experience. And today, we're here with Dave Miller of White Pine Winery. And we are in the town of...
St. Joseph.
Where right now it's snowing outside. Welcome to November.
That's right.
So how you doing, Dave?
Doing well.
Good. Thanks very much for making the time today. I appreciate it.
My pleasure.
Now, this is your tasting room where we're at, and our guests are going to see some video of this. And this is right in this little downtown area, which is just adorable, man. I mean, it's cute and easy access and a lot of different shops.
Yeah, there's restaurants, cool shops, and within walking distance is the beach. There's a carousel down there. There's a kids museum in town, some art galleries. So there's a lot going on here.
And you said you were the first tasting room down here.
We were. We opened in September of 2010.
Cool. And so 8 years is a pretty good length of time.
We consider that that means we're successful.
Yeah, clearly. Where is the winery itself located?
The winery is near Lawton, Michigan. So it's exit 60 off of I-94. And I moved to the area to be the winemaker at a large winery. And one of the reasons we put our tasting room in St. Joe is because I had a non-compete with them when I decided to go on my own. So now that non-compete has expired, and we're looking within a couple of years to have a tasting room out by the vineyard.
Oh, nice. Cool. Well, let's go back into your past. Actually, even before you started being a professional in the business, was there one of those wine moments for you where it was the aha moment where you said, wow, I like this. I wouldn't mind getting into this as a career.
You know, it's interesting because my background is in plant ecology. That's what I studied as an undergraduate, biology, plant ecology. And I had a professor that I became good friends with. And he and I would talk about what an interesting study in plant ecology wine grapes are. The vineyard, the site, the soil, the terroir, basically, and how that influenced wine. So I graduated with my bachelor's in 1982, and I think you're probably old enough to remember that was the Great Rust Belt Recession, and there were no jobs in Indiana, and I wasn't going to go rot in my parents' basement. So I moved to Colorado and lived in the mountains and worked at a ski resort for the winter. And while I was there, I took care of some nice restaurants and whatnot and noticed that wine was a big deal there. So I thought, well, hey, now there is maybe a career possibility. Get into wine, I can use my plant ecology background. And so that's where it started. I applied to graduate schools, was accepted at Michigan State. And once I got started there, then I had the opportunity to try some different wines and had my epiphanies a couple of times where I tried a wine and said, wow, I can't believe that came from grapes. How did they do that? I've got to know. And so here I am, you know, 35, 36 years later, and I'm still learning, but I've come a long way.
That's pretty much typical of anybody in the business, even people who drink wine. You're still learning.
And that's the cool thing about it. Everywhere you go, it's different. Every season's different. And one of the things I tell our customers is, when having been in the business as long as I have, growing grapes, making wine, being in all these places in the world, when you open a bottle of wine and pour it and smell it, it smells great. You taste it. It's just wonderful. You really appreciate what that represents. That's a lot of love, a lot of care. Somebody planted that vineyard in the right spot, took care of those grapes the right way, and nurtured that wine through the cellar and did everything right, and there it is for you. And it's a wonderful experience.
Were there wines from a particular area that, you know, I don't want to say got your attention, but really brought the passion out in you?
Well, back when I first started, everybody was pretty much focused on German Rieslings because we felt that that was what we could do best here. Just given there were almost no vinifera wines grown vinifera vines grown in the state of Michigan. Riesling was known to be one of the hardiest of the vinifera, and so some people had planted that and had made some nice wines, and so we focused on that quite a bit. Having some former students from the program I was in on the West Coast had an opportunity to go out and visit Napa and Sonoma back, you know, in the late 80s, and have some, you know, some great wine experiences out there, Pinot Noir, Zinfandel, some Cabernets and whatnot, and also in Oregon, Pinot Gris and Eastern Washington Rieslings from there. So those were sort of the beginning for me.
I would guess, just because of your background in your degree, that you weren't one of those people who were ignorant to the idea of what it takes to make wine. You were just the opposite. You were the guy that probably had a little more of a depth of understanding. Is that fair to say?
Well, I did have a background. I'd studied chemistry and biochem and those sorts of things as an undergraduate, microbiology. But it's amazing how many things can go wrong with wine. And so people ask me when we're talking to them in here, well, you know, if this is a world-class wine region, why doesn't the world know about it? And I said, you know, it's a fair question, but I said, if you look at Europe, they've had about 1,000 years to sort things out over there, maybe 1,500. We've been working on this since about the 1970s. Back in the 50s and 60s, it was just Concord, Niagara, American grape varieties grown here. Then people started bringing in hybrid grapes, resistant hybrids, Vidal Blanc, Sauval Blanc, those kinds of things, Marshall Foch. And so the wines became much better. They didn't have the American flavor. And then some people, but at that time, the prevailing wisdom was vinifera is not cold hardy enough. Well, we can't grow those grapes here. But nobody had tried it. So one of the things I spent a lot of time on at Michigan State was doing variety trials and testing what would work here. But anyway, there you get the right grape varieties. Well, how much should you crop? We've got a lot of juice grape growers around. It's all about yield. And wine grapes don't respond well to being handled that way. So we had a lot of research I did was on how much crop to take. Then canopy management, trellising, rootstocks, vineyard floor management, all the things that influence vine vigor and fruit exposure. So those things in the vineyard, you start getting those sorted out, and then there's a lot that goes into the winemaking. There are things that can be done wrong. Yeast nutrition, that's one of the biggies. If you don't have happy yeast, they'll get stressed and they'll put bad flavors in the wine. And, you know, without somebody showing you where those flavors came from, you're kind of at a loss. Did those come from the vineyard? Did I do something in the vineyard? Is that a spoilage organism? So a lot of research has been done all over the world since the 80s to sort these things out, and we've all learned together. We weren't the only ones making mistakes. California was doing the same thing, and Europe and whatnot. But there's a lot of really excellent technology out there now. There's just a lot more knowledge in the world, so the wines are cleaner these days. We're cropping at the correct levels. Red wines, there are things you have to do to stabilize pigments in reds and develop the mouthfeel that nobody knew. The old world, you know, they had, you could learn from the masters there, but as far as understanding the chemistry behind it, that's really just been sorted out in the last 20 years. But we're using all those things, and as we were talking earlier, you know, some of the other wineries around are doing the same thing, and we're amazed at the wonderful quality we get. We send our wines to competitions and win awards pretty much wherever we go, so it says we must be doing something right. We're on the right track.
Sure. Well, and as you said before, if you didn't make the mistakes, you wouldn't learn.
That's right.
Yeah, that's a big part of that.
Well, it helps you really appreciate it when you don't make mistakes.
Yeah. Well, that's a little more profitable that way, that's for sure.
Right, yeah.
So as a professional, what was your first year in the business?
So I worked at Michigan State as a technician after I got my master's degree. Back then, in the 80s, there were 14 wineries in the state. And they were mostly family-owned. A lot of them were farmers.
What year would that have been?
86.
Okay.
So there are a lot of more farmers looking to do the value-added stuff, and more and more people were going to Europe and visiting Geisenheim in Germany or maybe going to Bordeaux or Champagne, the cooler regions, because we knew we were more like those than we were like California. And so some good things were coming out, and you're starting to get some wine writers and some awards and competitions. So, but there was a lot we didn't know. So that was at Michigan State. I didn't go to St. Julian to work there until 97. And so I'd learned a lot in that time. I'd done my PhD work, and my PhD was on crop load. How much leaf area do we need to ripen an amount of fruit? And when I started, we didn't even know what questions to ask. Growers were saying, well, we can take 10 tons of the acre, and we're thinking, man, it sure doesn't make very good wine. But, and we're saying, no, we think you should only be taking maybe 4 tons of the acre. And, nobody wants to hear that. That means they're making a lot less money. Right. So we had to have some data to work with. And that's what I did for my dissertation. So we found out that, somewhere in the 3 to 3.5 ton range for red vinifera, somewhere in the 4.5 to 5 ton range for white vinifera worked really well. And we started implementing that, and it was working great. The growers were making money. The wines were winning awards. So my first year at the large winery, there was a lot wrong with the way the growers were growing the grapes. I mean, that was one of the reasons I was hired. They were growing pretty much everything like juice grapes, and that just doesn't work for vinifera. Right. It's a top wire trellis, and everything's hidden in the shade of the leaves. So I went out and started preaching the gospel of better viticulture. Some guys were excited that we were going to turn a corner and really start seeing better grapes, and other people chased me out of their vineyard and
said,
"That's
the part I'm curious about." Yeah, resistance.
Who do you think you are? You got a couple degrees. I've been doing this for 5 generations. And I respectfully left their vineyard, and it is their land, and they can do what they want to with it. But we stopped buying those grapes. So the people who were doing things the right way, immediately we started seeing a big change in the wine quality and more reporters coming to the area, more ink spilled about what we were doing, and sales started going up. So then I had the conversations with the growers, you can take a big crop one year and you go to the bank, you make a lot of money that year, but I've got this lousy wine I've got to sell. People will buy it once. They won't come back and buy it again.
Right.
What we need to do is make good wine consistently. The people will buy it, they'll come back and buy it again. And the way you're going to make money is you're going to plant more acres of grapes ultimately. So it's a very long view. It's like planting oak forests for, your great-grandkids or whatever. But again, there were those who saw that and understood it. I traveled to California with a couple of folks that are in the business, and because I know a lot of people on the West Coast, and we had the opportunity. One of my friends was a manager for the Tokalon Vineyard in Oakville.
Gee, I've heard of that.
Yeah. And so we went there. And
good place to go.
Yeah. To say, here's the way they do it here. What better example do you want? And for Beckstoffer, he was a manager for Beckstoffer. And he said, the way we handle the contracts here, $30,000 an acre, and you can take as much or as little crop as you want. Most people take 3 tons. And that was back in 07, I think we went out there. So $10,000 a ton fruit. So that got their attention. And we came back, and instead of trying to grow everything on, trellising that would yield higher yields, they started going for higher quality. And we've seen the results. The wines are much better than they used to be.
Yeah. Andy Beckstoffer definitely helped raise the bar quite a bit.
Yeah. Yeah, and he had a vision, and that's what it takes, somebody to say, I'm going to change the status quo, and I've got a new vision, and so that's what we tried to do. I said, I was looking to leave the corporate position and do my own thing, and I said, I could go get a job working for a winery out west somewhere or in New York, but it's going to be more of the same, or here we can start our own place. We already own 40 acres, but I said, you can still afford to do it here, and we can be leaders. And I grew up in South Bend. My wife's from Lansing. This is where we want to be anyway. So what the heck? This is the place to make our stand. Let's do it here. So we did. And we planted the vineyard that I used for my Cab Franc and Riesling in 1999. And that was so I'd have those grapes to demonstrate to the growers, the trellising we were using, vertical shoot positioned, and vineyard operations. Because what I would get from people in those early days was, well, you can't do that in Michigan. That doesn't work in Michigan. It takes too much time to do that. You can't do it here. So I did all the work myself by hand. Then I got, well, you're just a hobby viticulturist. You're not commercially, you're not making a living off it. So then when I got some of the commercial growers to do it, it got very quiet and you started seeing changes happen in other people's vineyards. And that was a good thing. It continues.
There is that idea of being a rebel from time to time that that creates change widespread. Cool. Good for you.
Yeah, thanks. Well, I always remember the old Mark Twain quote that 20 years from now, you'll be more, be more ashamed of the things you didn't do than the things you did.
Yeah.
So leave the safe harbor and set sail for the unknown, you know. And so I always had that taped over my desk and said, man, today's the day. Got to do it.
Yeah, a little inspiration. Cool. Well, congratulations to you for doing so well for so long.
Well, thank you.
Now, we're talking about vinifera. Is that exclusively what you grow?
I was growing just Riesling and Cabernet Franc, and then we had the polar vortex of 2014. We had another bad winter in 2015. So I had 2 years back-to-back with no crop. Been in this business since 1983, and I'd never seen that before. So I want to do a tasting room out on by my winery, and the township wanted me to grow more fruit that I produce so I could call it a farmer's market. They wanted me to grow at least half of what I'm producing. And so I planted a vineyard actually this spring. And I planted Chardonnay. And I also planted Chamberson, Traminet, and Marquette. Figured if I'm going to grow them, I'm going to have something every year.
Yeah.
And it's not as good a site as where I put the Riesling and Cab Franc. So, and in the beginning, too, I had the idea that I could just buy hybrids from other growers because there's more of them around. But you find there's a wide range of quality in any type of grape you purchase around here. So the best ones are under contract, and the stuff that's out there on the open market wasn't as desirable. So so we have a mix.
So obviously you have some estate fruit, and are you buying fruit otherwise?
Yes. Yeah, and it's all from Southwest Michigan. So we grow Riesling and Cab Franc, and I've got a variety called Regant. We use that for some of our blends, our red blends. But
is the Riesling dry? Is it sweet? Is it a do combination wine?
I have a dry, and I have a medium dry. That's a Cabernet style. That's a style I've always loved. So it's just a little bit sweet and low alcohol. So it's very popular. It's one of our best-selling whites.
Sure, I would think. And you're also appealing to different types of wine drinkers.
Right. And also trying to break the myth that so many people come in here, or the misinformation that a Riesling is only sweet.
Right. A lot of people think that.
Because most of what's on the market is just sweet. And it's too bad because there's such beautiful Rieslings out there, but unfortunately a lot of what's in the stores is not great.
It's a very underrated grape, and geez, it's affordable, folks.
Yeah. You know, back in the 16th and 17th centuries, Riesling was the wine in Europe. You know, it was the most highly sought after wine. Because I think probably back in those days, a lot of the red wines went bad during the barrel aging process.
Yeah, I'll bet.
Where Riesling comes in, it's got such high acidity and such low pH. It doesn't go bad. You almost have to try to make it bad. But the thing is, if you grow it in a climate where it's too warm, it makes a very nondescript, boring wine. It really needs to be in the right place. And these climates like ours, where it's snowing out there today, this is where Riesling really performs best.
Yeah. Now, as far as what you're doing, you also are teaching. You're at Michigan State, you said. And specifically, what are you teaching?
I teach a winemaking class, Chemistry 482. I've got two sections of 30 students, so 60 students. And we go through the basics of taking fruit from the vineyard and turning it into wine, getting it through the fermentation. And I remind all of them at the beginning of the class that completing this course does not qualify them to be professional winemakers, that it's a beginning, and if they want to pursue it, they should do internships with somebody who knows what they're doing and learn more that way.
Do you ever run into experienced winemakers who did not get formal educations wanting to take that class? I would think that'd be a big advantage for them.
Yeah, the problem is it's on campus, you know, and most people can't go to campus. So I also serve with a group called VESTA. It's the Viticulture and Enology Science and Technology Alliance. Nice mouthful. It's out of the University of Missouri. Mm. And that is funded by the National Science Foundation. And I've been on their curriculum advisory committee there, or what do they call it? The National Visiting Committee now since 2008. And that's an online program that you can take. We have a lot of people that are professionals in other fields that take those courses because they can take them online. And any testing they need to do, a lot of community colleges have that. And so they can get some hands-on at the community college, but get the curriculum when it's convenient for them.
Yeah, it certainly seems like a good opportunity.
It really is. It really is. That's why the NSF funded it, because as these cold hardy varieties from the University of Minnesota become available, suddenly you can grow grapes in Iowa, Nebraska, Kansas, Oklahoma. And, you know, where are those people going to learn the basics?
Right.
You know, so the online class was a no-brainer, I guess.
Yeah, the ongoing changing business of wine.
Yeah, it's fascinating. It's interesting. And you know, you meet people in the business, and most of us like being outside and getting our hands dirty and mm-hmm. tangibly turning a plot of land into a vineyard and turning those grapes into a glass of something that people enjoy. It's pretty gratifying.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, absolutely. And there's fun drinking it.
That's right.
Well, you know, as an educator, and I think you touched on this just with Riesling, but and since you have a tasting room, and I don't know if you yourself get time in here ever.
I do.
You know, are there questions that you get that you personally are sort of on a campaign to undo that myth? There are certain things that you hear about. I can see that right in your eyes.
Yeah. Well, the first one is the Riesling is only sweet. and so we dispel that myth right away. And then the other one that we hear often is Michigan can't do reds. Michigan wines are sweet and cheap. And we said, well, you know, let's do a tasting and you know, see what we've got. Most of my wines are dry. They're not all cheap. I don't have anything I would call cheap. I have some that are less expensive than others. But the reds that I do, we age in French oak barrels. French oak is expensive. And to do those wines that way costs more. But we think they're worth it, and so do our customers because they buy them. I read Robert Mondavi's book, Harvest of Joy, and Napa Valley used to be seen as a backwater, you know, in the wine world. They made these over-yielding Italian varietals that they sold by the tanker loads. And Mondavi went in and said, he got to know the Rothschilds and said, I'm going to do it the way they do it and see what happens. I think we can do better. And the rest is history. And so I took his gospel and applied it here. So when I first started, I had people saying, they asked how much I was going to charge for the wines. And I said, well, the reds that are barrel aged, we're going to be in the $22, $25, $28, you know, $30 range in there. And they said, you'll never sell those. Mm-hmm. $17, $18 is the best you can get. I said, well, if I start there and work backwards, I can't afford French oak barrels anymore. I'm going to be looking at American oak, which I think is too strong for our wines, or using oak chips in tanks, which I know doesn't do as good a job as the barrels. So I said, I'm going to buy the barrels and sell the wines for what I have to, and we'll see what happens. And we're here going on, working on our ninth year now. So
again, my hat's off to you.
Yeah.
You know, while these wines aren't cheap, they're certainly more affordable than buying a lot of typical cabs from somewhere like Napa or Sonoma.
So, yeah. Yeah, and the other thing we get too is a lot of people think that the Michigan wine industry is only up north. Those guys have done a great job up there. There's some beautiful wineries, beautiful landscape up there. I mean, I love being up there. And they've done a fantastic job, great wines. Really, you know, hats off to those guys. But it's 150 miles north of here, 3.5 hours, and it's a much cooler region with a shorter, cooler growing season. So we can do things down here. This is the area where Michigan wine first started, you know, 150 years ago. But there wasn't as much attention paid to this area, and because growers were growing juice grapes, they thought they knew how to grow grapes, and so there was a lot done wrong with wine grapes. And so we've kind of had to undo a lot of that, but we're making good progress and starting to get this area out there. And so we can do reds, all the wines. I mean, they're still inexpensive, sweet wines made, and there's a lot of those sold, and a lot of people want them. And, you know, whenever somebody comes in looking for that, we'll direct them to some of the other wineries in the area that we know have those wines. And, you know, we help each other out that way. I don't want to try to have everything for everybody. I've been in Europe. I've been in the West Coast. I've been down under, been in the East. I've been doing this for a long, long time. And the model that I wanted to use was that where we focus on a few grapes that do really well here and you know, show those off.
Yeah. And clearly you guys are on the road to do that and, again, get more attention that way. Now, the tasting room we're in, this is somewhere somebody could just walk right in, so no appointment necessary.
Nope.
and they could do a tasting and pretty much taste anything you have available?
Yes, we charge $8 to taste 6 samples, and we've got some dessert wines. We've got our reserve reds, our whites. We've got a sparkler that's bottle fermented in the classic style. Got a Chardonnay that's done like a white Burgundy, neutral barrels, stirred lees. So I'm after all these traditional styles and see how they work with our grapes. We've got a Riesling that's a stop fermentation, like a German Cabernet. So the sweetness in there is natural grape sugar. It's not added back. It's only about 10% alcohol, so it's light, it's fruity, perfect wine for the holidays. So yeah, you can try any of those, and there's some others too. Nice dry rosé.
Great reasons to come here and try the wines. And for our listeners who would like to learn about you online, what is your website?
WhitePineWinery.com.
Great. Well, this was great, Dave. I really appreciate you taking the time, and I wish you continued success. Thank you very much.
Well, thanks so much for coming in. It's great talking with you.
Learn more by visiting WhitePineWinery.com or check out MichiganWineCollaborative.com.
Thanks for listening, and remember to like us on Facebook. Also, check out our YouTube channel.
Life Between the Vines is produced at Fifth Floor Recording Company in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. Produced and edited by Ray Pfister. Theme song and original music written and recorded by Tim Dondarevo. Our host is Kay Paskoff. Our graphics and website specialist is Lawton Hall. Our web geek is Dan Gieschen. Photos by Jeanette Herniak. Copyright 2018.